Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Peter Mayers with you, sitting in for Ramona Cavale until the end of next week. I'm very glad to be here while Ramona has a brief mid-year break. Today on the show, Australian writer Julia Lee joins me to talk about her new novel, Disquiet. And I have to say, it's a very apt title for this brooding work. And I'll speak to lawyer-turned-translator Kieran Tapsell. After learning Spanish in his 50s, he decided that he could make retirement more interesting by translating one of Colombia's leading authors into English, just for fun, and because he thought his friends would enjoy the book. And in first person, we continue the classic Walden by Henry David Thoreau. Translating literature is no small undertaking, not something for the faint-hearted. It's time-consuming, painstaking work, and it throws up dilemmas about the use of language that can tax the most highly developed of literary skills. So when you hear that a retired Australian commercial lawyer who began teaching himself Spanish in his early 50s is now translating the work of major Latin American authors, well, you'd have to think that he was audacious or naive or foolhardy or perhaps all three. But Kieran Tapsell is in fact driven by intellectual curiosity, a love of language, and a desire to share good books with friends who don't speak Spanish. Kieran Tapsell, welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's first talk about the first book you translated, a book called The Oblivion We Become. Tell us about that book.
Well, it's written by Héctor Abad Faciolince, and I knew who he was, actually, because I used to, as part of trying to learn Spanish, read magazines in Spanish. And there was one called Semana, and he was a columnist there. And I was actually down on the Amazon on a houseboat with some Colombian friends whom I'd met again as part of my attempt to conquer Spanish. And one of them was reading this book called The Oblivion We Become. And when he wasn't reading it, I would pick it up. And I just got absolutely fascinated by it. So, of course, I got myself a copy and then read it. And I was actually looking around for sort of more interesting ways, more fun ways of actually expanding my vocabulary. So I wrote to the author. I found his email address and I wrote to him and I said, look, do you mind if I translate your book? I just want to improve my Spanish. And I don't know whether it's going to be any good or not, but you can have the copyright in it so long as I've got the right to give it to some of my friends.
And what he probably thought, who's this nutter from Australia? What did
he
say?
That's exactly the word he used. Well, not nutter, but he said, this is really strange. He said, it's a lot of work to translate something, but, well, why not? Hmm. So I did. It took me about 3 months. And
You must have been working pretty hard then.
Yeah, I was. I was constantly going to the dictionary. But I just loved this book. It was really one of the most moving books I've ever read. It reminded me a little bit of Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom. It was that sort of really powerful book.
Well, let's tell the listeners a bit about the book. It's as you say, by a Colombian writer called Héctor Abad Faciolince, and he's writing about his father, Héctor Abad Gómez.
That's right. Yeah.
A crusading doctor.
He was. He was a professor of public health at a university in Medellin. And he used to say to the public authorities, look, what's the point in me designing systems to hand out diarrhea pills, for example, to these people when they haven't got clean water? Give them clean water. Now, in the political situation that existed in Medellin at that time, there were groups of people who thought that because he was wanting to improve the lot of the poor people, that he was in fact a dangerous lefty. And when he finally retired, the bloodshed and the conflict in Colombia had become much worse, no doubt with, you know, a lot of these drug cartels and so forth. And he then decided, as a former professor of public health, that the really number one health problem in Colombia was actually violence. So he became the head of, I suppose, the equivalent of Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, one of those things. And the right-wing paramilitaries ended up assassinating him. They had this list of people that they would assassinate, and because they had this idea that they were a cancer on society and needed to be eliminated.
And it's a very affectionate. I mean, I'm lucky. You sent me a copy of your translation, and I haven't read it all, but I read the opening 8 or 10 chapters or so. It's a very affectionate portrayal of his father. And it has that sense of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's book, A Death Foretold.
Exactly.
Because you know what's going to happen. So there's this, you know what's coming in it for this wonderful man. He's presented as an absolutely wonderful man. Now, this has been a runaway bestseller, this book in Latin America,
I
think.
That's right. And he never expected it to be. He thought it was a very Colombian book and about Colombia. And it's gone into 15 editions throughout South America. And then when it was published in Spain, and not very long ago, it's now got into, I think, at least 4 there now. So, I mean, it is obviously going to appear in English at some time or another. But
will it be your translation that appears in English?
And probably not. And in fact, when I did it, I wrote to him and I said, now look, if you do want to use it, you better get someone to check it. I mean, I'm not a professional translator. I've done the best, but there's obviously ways it can be improved.
Well, but you've sent it to him, and he presumably has read it or had other people read it for him if he doesn't speak much English, Hector Abad, the author.
Oh, he does speak English.
And what's his opinion of your translation?
Well, he said to me quite honestly, he is a translator, by the way. When his father got assassinated, he actually fled to Italy because he was on the death list too. And he became a translator from Italian into Spanish. So he knows what it's all about, but he said to me, honestly, he wouldn't be able to pass a judgment as to whether it was good or not. But what he has done is he has sent it on to quite a few friends and, well, other authors. For example, I think Aminata Fauna, the British writer, her father was assassinated too, and he met her at a literary conference, so she's got a copy of it. And there have been several other people as well.
And what's the verdict? Are you getting a verdict on your translation? I mean, well, I must say it read very well to me, but not knowing the original, it's hard to tell.
Well, of course, that's the other thing about how accurate it is. I think, well, he just said he's had a lot of success with it, whatever that means. But as I said, I wouldn't be happy about it being published in its present form. I'd really want to either have someone look at it or at least work with someone to improve it.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm talking to Kieran Tapsell, who's a retired lawyer who's taken up sort of volunteer translating from Spanish into English, books that he finds interesting or that he thinks other people should read. Now, Kieran, the other remarkable thing is that you're a relative newcomer to speaking Spanish yourself.
Yes, I started about 11 years ago. Look, I always wanted to learn another language, to be honest, and but, of course, being a lawyer, I was working with words all day, and to come home at night time and then work with more words is like going back to work, so I put it off and put it off. But eventually, after a visit to Venezuela about 11 years ago, I realised I was in a completely different world there. I mean, it was not like Africa or Europe where you can get by really well with English. And I just thought I was missing out on so much by not knowing the language, so that's when I started.
And you had some novel techniques for learning, teaching yourself Spanish.
Well, yes, that's right. I had enough of classes at university, and I really prefer to teach myself things. So I basically did teach myself, and I didn't have any difficulty with the structure of Spanish because I'd learned Latin and ancient Greek when I was younger. But, of course, one thing I couldn't learn to teach myself was to speak it, and for that reason, I went to classes for about 12 months at the University of Wollongong, and I remember sitting through these classes, and I think, I am never going to learn to speak this language.
Sort of 2 hours a week or something like that.
That's right.
I think we've all been there, or a lot of us have, doing those sort of once a week after work classes or what have you.
And I discussed this with various friends and said, look, you've really got to go to the country. Well, that wasn't very convenient for me, except as a visitor, but they talked about going to live there, so I decided to bring the country to me.
How did you do that?
Well, I looked around for Spanish speakers, and I used to invite them up to barbecues and things fairly regularly, and we just talk Spanish.
And you found plenty of Spanish speakers in Wollongong?
I found, well, there was actually a whole lot of South American students down there, and I met them and I met their families, and I, since then, of course, I've been over there. And that's how it's all started.
So it's also changed the way in which you travel, obviously, because you now have contacts in the country.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. The other thing I was referring to when I talked about your novel way of learning Spanish was that you would read books English and Spanish books in tandem. So you'd read the Spanish version and the English version at the same time. And you did this with, of all things, James Joyce's Ulysses. And you found it easier to read in Spanish than in English.
Well, look, that started off as a bit of a joke because a friend of mine was actually reading Ulysses and he asked me if I'd ever read it. And I said, no, I hadn't. He said, oh, look, you want to read it. It's fabulous. And I said, look, I'm so busy reading Spanish books. And his wife actually got me a Spanish translation of Ulysses and gave it to me for Christmas. So I actually felt a bit obliged to read it. But, of course, I got the original as well. So I actually read it in both languages. And the odd thing was, there were certainly times when I understood the Spanish better because James Joyce, as you know, uses a lot of Dublin slang, which, you know, was just like a foreign language to me. So, but the translator, of course, had to actually find out what it meant and then put it into simple Spanish. So I had this unusual experience of reading Ulysses and understanding it better in Spanish.
Well, I have to admit, I've struggled with Ulysses, so perhaps I should try reading it in another language and maybe maybe I'll do better. Kieran Tapsell, you've now translated a second book. You've not only translated The Oblivion We Become, but you've now translated a second book, a 640-page popular science book about memory called Homo Sapiens.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's not just about memory. It's actually the sort of thing that you hear about on the ABC's All in the Mind program. So it's about really evolutionary psychology, about neuroscience, and I just found that fascinating as well.
And so again, you found it so interesting, you thought other people should read this, I'm going to translate it into English.
Well, look, when I wrote to Hector, Abed asked me, you know, to make some commentary about his The Oblivion We Become, which I did. And in the process of that, because I'd already read Homo Sapiens in Spanish, I actually said to him, look, I was just talking about memory, about how our memory goes through filters and so forth, and I just referred to this book, and he said, look, it's funny you should mention that book because Antonio Velez is a very good friend of mine, and if you've really got nothing much better to do in your retirement, perhaps you might like to do his for him. So I did have other better things to do, but I decided to do it anyway. And so I wrote to Antonio Velez, and he wrote back and said, look, this is like winning the lottery. Do you really want to do it? And so I said, yes. So I used to send him over a chapter. He speaks quite reasonable English. And we had this wonderful collaboration whereby, you know, every week a new chapter would go over and he'd fix it up. It of course, had a lot of technical terms, which I wasn't familiar with, so he helped me with those. And eventually, after 4 months, I had that finished, and that's now anyone can read it now on the internet.
That one's freely available, and we'll put a link to it on the Book Show website for those who might be interested to read it.
Yeah.
I wonder, Kieran Tapsell, if you've copped any criticism from professional translators who are very undervalued and underpaid, in my view, for their work. Do you get people saying, "Look, you're undercutting our market by going out and doing this for free"?
Well, I think in the case of Homo sapiens, it wouldn't have been done. I think it's as simple as that. There was no plans to translate it at all. In Hector's case, of course, I'm sure it will be done, but I'm sure it will also be employing a translator. I don't think they'll just take mine.
Mm. But have you discovered other people doing similar things, translating for love like you are?
No, I haven't heard about it. I think that's why Hector said it was a rather strange request.
But it's been, I mean, a lot of work, but personally rewarding for you.
Oh, look, it's extremely rewarding. I mean, I never realised until I started it how creative it is.
As a process?
The process. The process is enormously creative. It's to be able to transfer meaning from one language to another, I think is, and to get it right and to get it to read well and things like that is really quite, well, it's difficult, but it's also creative. And of course there were certain things, for example, Antonio Velez would use some Colombian, well, I suppose you call them slang expressions, and then I had to look around for something in English. And sometimes it was really very, very difficult to do, and sometimes I just couldn't do it. You just had to forget about it.
But you're not only improving your Spanish, you're improving your English along the way.
Exactly, and that's the other thing which I think is just extraordinary, is that my English has improved enormously, despite the fact of being a lawyer for so long.
You've managed to overcome that obstacle of legalese.
Well, that's right, but still, you need to know your grammar at least when you're a lawyer, but Now I've learned a lot about English just by learning Spanish, and that's one of the things I just find a little bit depressing when you read about this lack of support for languages these days. And then at the same time, complaints that children aren't learning grammar properly. Well, if you want to teach them grammar, teach them another language, because they have to learn by rules. If they're going to learn by rules, then they'll have to learn their own rules.
Kieran Tapsell, thank you very much for joining me on The Book Show, and good luck with whatever you happen to translate next.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter.
Kieran Tapsell is a retired Australian lawyer and, as you heard, freelance translator of Latin American literature. And as I said, we'll put a link on The Book Show website to his translation of that popular science book about the mind and memory, Homo Sapiens. Go to our site at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow.
Shush!
Shush yourself! Now's no time to be quiet about your favourite museum. You go to them, you enjoy them. Now here's your chance to work with them. Rattle them bones, get a full head of steam, and enter the inaugural Marvellous Regional Museums Awards. If your museum's judged the overall winner, we'll broadcast from it, wherever it is in Australia. Marvellous Museums. All the details are at the Radio National website. Entries close June 20.
You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Peter Mayers, standing in for Ramona Cavale. In 1999, Australian author Julia Lee won international acclaim for her first novel, The Hunter, the story of a mercenary sent to the Tasmanian wilderness by a multinational biotech company to track down and kill the last Tasmanian tiger in order to harvest its genetic material. Lee was named by the Observer newspaper as one of the 21 novelists to watch in the 21st century, but it's taken 9 years for her second novel to appear, a slim volume, a novella in fact, called Disquiet. Disquiet is the story of a woman returning to the family chateau in France after a long absence in Australia. She carries the scars of a failed and brutal marriage and is accompanied by her two children, who've never before met their French relatives. Julia Lee's two novels, The Hunter and Disquiet, are very different stories, and yet there are some key similarities between them, as we'll hear. Julia Lee, welcome to The Book Show.
Hi, Peter.
And congratulations on Disquiet. I can honestly say that I couldn't put it down. It was amongst a big pile of books I was given a few weeks back when I was asked to stand in for Ramona. And, you know, I was given these books and told to, you know, have a look and see what you think. And I picked your book up knowing nothing about it, nothing about you, and I read it from cover to cover.
Oh, fantastic.
And I think it's a story I think best approached without knowing too much about the plot. So I'm going to try and avoid talking about everything that happens in the book. But I will say it lives up to its name. It is disquieting.
Yeah, sure is. Disturbing, disquieting. Yes, these are the areas I go into, I guess.
I'll ask you just if you could to briefly read from a section near the opening of Disquiet.
Okay. The stone stairs leading to the chateau were wide and shallow and worn like soap. The woman took hold of the door knocker. It was a large bronze ring running through the nose of a great bronze bull, and weighed it in her hand, knocked. They waited patiently, and their kind of patience was born more from exhaustion, from abandoning any expectation of easy gratification, than from gracious goodwill. She reached out to ruffle the boy's hair, to give them both some courage, knock, knock. An old woman answered. She was wearing her perennial uniform, a black dress and a white apron, and her hair, grey now, was curled in a tidy bun. They stared at one another without speaking, and between them passed an understanding of the unsung miracle of the door. One moment a person wasn't there, and the next moment, there. Peering inside, the children spied the entrance hall. It was austere and immense. The wood-panelled walls were painted palest dove grey. High ceilings lent it the authority of a church or a courthouse, although this authority was undermined by brightly coloured helium balloons weighted down in vases and tied along the banisters of the grand central staircase. "Hello, Ida," said the woman calmly. "It's me." "Hello, Olivia. May I introduce the children?" Each child gave a limp wave. Ida noted the boy's bloodied shoulder, his torn shirt and trousers, but held her tongue. She bent down and twinkled her fingers in greeting, ushered them inside. Grandmother crowned the staircase. She was impeccably dressed in a matching boucle jacket and skirt, a faultless string of pearls. A sceptral silver-topped walking stick rested by her side. Though small and frail, the impression she gave was one of dignified resignation. "Hello, Mother. Hello, Olivia." The woman climbed the marble stairs, and when she reached her mother, she took a soft, scaly hand and kissed it, a formal gesture, not one of reconciliation. And her mother, in turn, made an assessment. The straggled hair, the torn stockings, the broken arm. Tactful, she determined not to pass comment. "I needed to come home," said the woman. There was a long silence. "Well, meet the children."
Julia Lee reading from Disquiet, her latest novel. And Julia Lee is my guest on the book show. Julia Lee, your writing is sparse. It's stripped back and concentrated. Is that something that takes a lot of time?
Yes, it does. I mean, I pay great attention to the fall of the word on the page. And so I am very concerned to work with language. And actually, just to give you an example from that reading. So this sentence, for example, "The stone stairs leading to the chateau were wide and shallow and worn like soap." And I can say that the effect I was trying for there was the rhythm of walking up the stairs is reflected in that sentence itself.
Well, that was one of the lines that caught my ear, if you like, when I read and when I selected that bit for you to read, and partly because it also emphasises another aspect of your writing, which seems to me you're very careful in your use, or restricted maybe in your use of adjectives and adverbs, and prefer to use metaphor and imagery. So we have the stone stairs shaped like soap, worn like soap.
Yes, I'm quite careful. I guess another interesting thing with the language of this piece is there's very little interiority. So, for example, we don't have Olivia was thinking this or Olivia was feeling this. So we're not really going inside her head. And instead, I've sort of given myself some restraints, if you like, in the language.
Well, I was actually going to ask you about that. I mean, that struck me as well. You don't go inside your characters' heads. You observe them. And I'm going to read another little example of the way in which you do this. You observe their actions and you leave it for the reader to interpret, I suppose, what's going on, to build the story around that character. It's another example here of just of the way in which you do that. So this is a little quote from later in the novel. "Very slowly, the woman reached for her wine glass, as if there were a mountain range between her hand and the glass that could only be negotiated with the utmost concentration." Is that the kind of, I mean, that's what I felt, that you're giving, you describe very, in quite intricate detail, a very small movement. And in doing so, you tell us a lot about that character.
Yes, that's right. This novella, because of this restriction about interiority, there's more focus on gesture, being in the world, and particularly for Olivia, because she has arrived with a broken arm. She's usually right-handed, and now she has to use her left hand. And I actually have broken my wrist before, but what the effect of that is suddenly your everyday life, your everyday gestures, picking up a cup of coffee, washing your hair in the shower, you see everything in a new light. I think there's a line somewhere in there about it's strange that we all seem to have a left-hander inside us that we didn't know we had. This is also part of the story. See, every element has to feed into the bigger picture, and it's part of the story too, because Olivia's come home and she's moving through the world. Let's say she's haunted by death. It's a bit of a liminal time. And so perhaps these gestures are being committed as if for the first and last time.
The restraint of your language also reinforces the confined world of the story itself, because almost everything takes place within the walls of this chateau, with its formal, highly manicured gardens and tightly ordained rules of behaviour. The children, for example, are not allowed to run through the parquet hallways.
Yes, there's that's right. That sense of formality in the language is also reflected in the grounds of the chateau. And I don't know if you're familiar with those sort of French formal gardens where there's a sense of unashamed artifice and a sense of controlling the essentially uncontrollable, which is the natural world. So there's always maintenance and this sort of aspect of artifice and control. And also with the family in the chateau and in the sort of world that they're in, there's a sort of masked politesse, a family where things aren't brought out into the open and discussed.
And strict rules of behaviour about how to eat soup, for example.
Yes, yes, yes.
From review, you're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. My guest is Julia Lee, and we're discussing her new novel, Disquiet. Julia Lee, from reviews, it seems that your style of writing does divide readers. The atmosphere in Disquiet is, I think as listeners might get the impression from us talking, it is almost suffocating. And for some readers find that too much.
It's hard for me to comment on that because these are the sort of fundamental aesthetic choices that I made from the outset. So I think you have to go with that. I mean, this is the book I wanted to write. I didn't set out to write a sprawling family saga. I like to read works of literature where, the language itself sort of suffuses the world of the book and, really gets under your skin.
And I describe Disquiet, I think, as brooding, and that there's a sense of foreboding, some would even say menace in the book. But there's no overt violence. There's no violence on the page. There's no blood spilt as such.
Yeah, I think sometimes when you leave things unsaid, you can create this powerful sense of the hidden. And this goes to atmosphere, I guess. Yeah, to create an atmosphere, in a work.
In my introduction, I mentioned your first novel, The Hunter. And after reading Disquiet, I immediately sought out The Hunter and read that too.
Oh, great.
And, they're very different stories, but there is a common element. Both novels deal with children, and in each case, a brother and a sister, whose parents have failed them in some form and who end up then taking matters into their own hands.
Yeah, there is a divide between the world of the children and the world of the adults. I guess in both books. I mean, Olivia in Disquiet, it's quite a taboo, actually, I think, that she, she's disavowing her children. And I think for a parent, man or woman of any young child, that's pretty big step. And I like very much Andy, the boy in Disquiet, and how he sees the world and how he conducts himself and carries on. And I guess I do think that there is a sort of division or separation between the world of adults who are like controllers and then the world of children.
The role of children in the novel has prompted one reviewer of Disquiet to compare it to Ian McEwan's novel Atonement, where, of course, a child plays a key role, as people will know if they've read that or seen the movie. But I actually saw a much closer link to another earlier Ian McEwan novel, a darker Ian McEwan novel.
And that's going to say The Cement Garden?
I am.
I first read... That was the first Ian McEwan book I read, actually.
Me too,
This was some time ago, so you have to forgive me for not remembering it exactly. But I know that when I read that book, it was one of those books that, it made a profound impression on me. This is like the world of sort of young people who, they're on their own in their own world. I think I prefer the cement garden to Atonement.
Yeah. I think I do as well. I mean, yeah. It is darker, and it's a very dark book, and it struck me with very great force when I first read it as well. In fact, you in your other novel, The Hunter, your main character makes reference to the cement garden. He actually refers to it at one point.
Oh, really?
You don't remember that? He's reminded of a book he read about two children. But anyway, look, the other thing that I've seen in...
Right. Actually, that I know what you're talking about. Mm. That could have been the cement garden, that's right, but I think it was just a general reference. But maybe you've thrown light on that.
Certainly.
I didn't realise it was there.
I certainly thought it was the cement garden when I read it, but there you go. Yeah. Some reviews of that first novel, The Hunter, criticise you for not developing the characters enough, and the same criticism's been levelled at Disquiet. But it seems to me that this is a sort of misplaced criticism, because you quite clearly decide, as you've said about interiority, you decide not to tell us what people are thinking. You quite clearly decided not to develop character in that way.
I actually think the works are quite different. I think in The Hunter, I mean, to be honest, it was extremely well received, The Hunter, so I don't think many people felt that about the development of the main character in The Hunter, and we did spend, because he was in the wilds of Tasmania for much of the time, we did spend time with him in his head and how he was constructing nature. I was interested in how we think about the natural world, how we think about what sort of stories we tell ourselves about the role of man in nature, man and animals. But with Disquiet, yes, it was much more of a stronger choice to... Well, yeah, as we've discussed, to not go inside. But I hope that character can come through in all these other ways.
Well, you also refer to your characters not by name. I mean, the hunter, for example, his name is M. We don't know much more about him. The woman, Olivia, has a name, but you very rarely use it. You essentially refer to her throughout the book as the woman.
My grammar for that was when I was in this sort of authorial mood, I would use the woman, but if another character in the book was talking to her, they would say Olivia, so we learned her name that way. Why did I do this? I think it has... gives the work a sort of a gentle distance in a way. It adds to that observational quality. There's a lot of a feeling and disquiet of people hiding things and watching. I don't know. Maybe it gives me the distance as the writer as well.
Well, it's also you don't answer all our questions. I mean, we know that Olivia is fleeing a marriage that's failed and that has involved violence, but you don't tell us that story. We know the hunter is working for some biotech company, that he's a mercenary, but you don't tell us who the company is, what they're really after. You leave that up to the reader, which I like, and that's obviously a deliberate strategy as well.
Yeah, it is. I think what's really powerful in Disquiet is where Olivia is coming from is a situation that is extremely hard, where she hasn't left for a long time, an abusive situation, and that has a lot of difficult attendant feelings. Complex, and perhaps shame is one of those strong feelings. She is pretty much burnt through. I don't want to paint a psychological rationale for her mind. So she's visited this disappointment upon herself, and I think that the way that she has to deal with that form of loss is sort of a deep theme of the book.
Julia Lee, in 2003, I think it was, you were awarded a mentorship with the Nobel Prize-winning American author Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
You went, I think you were living in the US, so you spent a lot of time with Toni Morrison. How valuable has that been to your work?
Well, that was a terrific, amazing thing to happen, to receive an email in the inbox out of the blue inviting me to apply for this program that I never heard of. In fact, no one had ever heard of it because it was the first time ever. But when I saw that Toni Morrison's name was attached, I thought, well, if she's given it her imprimatur, then it can't be too bad. And, yeah, it was a rare privilege to see somebody who has so successfully made a life for themselves as a writer and who has a body of work, you know, who has... that's what I aspire to create a body of work.
And how did the mentorship work? I mean, did you send her things to read and then get her response, or did you talk about what it means to be a writer and the process of establishing yourself?
Well, it was all a bit strange because actually Toni read Disquiet more or less when it was finished. The first draft didn't... I worked very closely on the first draft, so they didn't actually change that much in rewrites. But I sort of began the program with a different project with her, and in that case I did write some pages, send them to her, and she would sort of make editorial comments. But I also spent time with her, you know, attending a conference with her or just going to the theatre or just sort of these spending time.
More relaxed. Well, she's certainly given Disquiet a big rap, as people will see on the front cover. So, Julia Lee, thank you very much for joining me on The Book Show.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
And Julia Lee's novel Disquiet is published by Penguin Australia. On our next program, after 10 o'clock this morning, Growing Up Asian in Australia, a new anthology of stories by Asian Australian writers. I'll be joined by editor Alice Pung and by contributor Shalini Akhil. Also, Welsh-Chinese author Peter Ho Davis, who was shortlisted for last year's Booker Prize. So please join me on The Book Show after the 10 o'clock news this morning. Also, we want your thoughts on libraries. Public libraries in New South Wales have threatened to charge for services if they don't get more funding. Library users continually say they want more books and more book-based programs, but would a fee for service be too high a price to pay for improved resources? We'll be discussing the future of public libraries on The Book Show on Friday, and in the meantime, we'd like your thoughts about libraries. Why you love them, how much you depend on them, whether they're better or worse than they used to be. Send us your thoughts on libraries by clicking the Have Your Say button on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow, where, of course, you can also download this program as a podcast. Now it's goodbye from me, Peter Mayers. On ABC Radio National, it's time for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.